The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're talking about what happens when scientific research clashes with ethics and common decency. Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Alan Hornblum. Before devoting all his time to researching and writing about the people and events he felt had been neglected over the years, Alan's professional life included stints as a prison literacy instructor, congressional staffer, cable television host, and law enforcement administrator. It was his passion for revealing social inequalities and instances of outright abuse that resulted in his leaving his position in the sheriff's office to research and chronicle the history of the Holmesburg prison medical experiments for his book, Acres of Skin. And he's here to talk about his most recent book, Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. Welcome, Alan.
Good to be with you, Desiree.
Now, I read a lot. I always have a book in my hand. So people often ask me, what are you reading now? And when I was reading your book, I would answer that I was reading about medical experimentation on children. And people, interestingly, would invariably follow up with, oh, in Germany? Or, oh, the Soviets? There was definitely a level of surprise and confusion that I was referring to the U.S. Did you have the same experience when you were writing it?
Not quite. I know this book will be a great shock to the American citizenry. I'm sure they believe that these nefarious tales only took place in Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. But in fact, a good many medical experiments did occur in America during the 20th century, and in fact, some still continue. I got into this subject, as you briefly explained in your introduction, when I worked in the Philadelphia prison system back in the 1970s. I was appalled and stunned by a number of things I saw, not the least of which were the scores and scores of men who were strapped and wrapped in bandages and all sorts of medical tape and gauze. And I wondered to myself, could this facility, this prison, be this unsafe? You know, had there just been a knife fight on a cell block or a gang war in the prison yard? And the next day I asked a cell block guard and he told me that it was, oh, that's nothing, Mr. Hornblum. That's just the perfume experiments for the University of Pennsylvania. And I was like taken aback. I mean, you know, somebody's, you know, testing, you know, arpeggio by Lanvin on A block. It really didn't ring true to me. And I peppered the guard with questions for another 20 minutes, a half hour, until he finally got tired of me. And he said, look, Mr. Hornblum, these experiments aren't new. You are. They've been going on for 20 years now. And you and I wouldn't do it. But these inmates are absolutely desperate for money. And this is the only way that they can get money for commissary or to pay their lawyer or to get out on bail or whatever. And for that day and the many days thereafter, I just quizzed a lot of people about the experiments because it struck me, if not something that was a recipe for disaster, it was at least a recipe for abuse and some serious physical damage. I always expected that there would be a journalist, a medical ethicist, a historian who would write the history of those prison experiments, but it never happened. And it was not for another couple decades that while I was working in the sheriff's office, I started to really reflect on those experiments. And I basically adopted the position that if I did not do it, they would never be known. So I threw myself into the project. I gave up my job in the sheriff's office, started researching the issue full time, and after 5 years of research and writing, Acres of Skin came out in 1998. But getting back to your original question, it was during that research project that I started coming across all of these experiments on children. Against Their Will is the history of using institutionalized children as raw material for experimentation in America.
Well, let's provide a bit of background here. You use the term eugenics throughout the book. So what exactly are we referring to?
It was a movement that got its start in England in the early 1880s, but it was really picked up with great force in America in the 1890s and in the 20th century, the first three decades of the 20th century for sure. And what they tried to do is really perfect mankind, try to develop the genetic makeup, the gene pool, so that the best of society would perpetuate themselves, and those who were an anchor or an albatross would be taken out of society. So there was this movement, positive eugenics as well as negative eugenics, and negative eugenics really took hold to clean the gene pool in America. And they wanted to institutionalize all of those individuals who may have had anything that separated themselves from society. It could have been their hearing or their eyesight, or they could have been a little bit slow intellectually. The term feeble-minded was greatly used during those early decades. Institutions across the country were very, very aggressive in putting people away, locking them up, sterilizing them, castrating them to try and get them out of society so that they would not perpetuate themselves. There were some very educated, renowned Americans who were pushing this, and Margaret Sanger, Teddy Roosevelt, Alexander Graham Bell, very prominent people were became wedded to this movement. And in addition to institutionalizing all of these people who they felt were dragging society down, there was also a movement taking place in the 1920s that we mention in the book, and that was the one that glorified doctors and scientists. Journalists in the 1920s, starting with Paul de Kruijf that we outline in his book, The Microbe Hunters, greatly accentuated the hero worshiping of the great doctors and scientists who were fighting yellow fever, and they were fighting pellagra, and they were fighting all these diseases that were killing and maiming Americans. So what you had was basically this perfect storm developing during the early decades of the 20th century, where on the one hand, we were institutionalizing a great many people, taking them out of society and trying to get rid of them. On the other hand, we have some of the best people in society who were pursuing all of these cures and preventatives, and the polity, society is generally patting them on the back, encouraging them. But all of these doctors who were doing this great work, when they came up with some elixir, some sort of medicinal substance that they felt was going to make inroads against polio or cancer or tuberculosis, we needed to test these various elixirs on people. Doctors knew where to go to do their experiments. They went to the many orphanages, the mental institutions, the insane asylums, the prisons, where we had people who were basically throwaway humans. Folks did not care about them. And that's where a lot of the top scientists of the 20th century initiated research projects.
You're listening to Science for the People, and my guest is Alan Hornblum, author of Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. How exactly did we go from sort of warehousing these children closer to World War I to using them as captive test subjects?
Well, it really was a natural progression. As you go through those early decades of the 20th century, our insane asylums and prisons and orphanages are growing by leaps and bounds. And many doctors are very much frustrated. For example, in the field of mental health, these insane asylums are growing in every state in America. And the doctors really have little in their armamentarium that is able to successfully fight and thwart this growth. And they're all searching desperately for various mechanisms or theories or elixirs that will try and combat this problem. So a lot of these doctors are well-intended, but they buy into various schemes and theories and initiatives that anecdotally seem to show some success, but without really doing the research that is necessary to document it, they embark on their own initiatives. And for example, we have a very prominent 20th century psychiatrist by the name of Loretta Bender, who's very well known in the field, who in the 1930s was basically assessing and analyzing a great many children as suffering from schizophrenia. And one of the mechanisms, remedial initiatives that she thought held some success was ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. And so what you have is a prominent doctor at Bellevue Hospital in New York City who is doing research, who is initiating all sorts of efforts to thwart childhood schizophrenia by putting more and more children on a series of ECT examinations. Are great shocks to the brain, electrifying the brain, as some would argue, and children would get a battery of 20 of them, or 25 of them, or 40 of them. And interestingly enough, another 20 years later, the same psychiatrist, Dr. Bender, in the 1950s, becomes a devotee of a new elixir that she thinks holds some potential success, and that is LSD. She is one of the first practicing physicians who starts doing experiments on autistic children, giving autistic children daily doses of LSD, sometimes twice a day over a period of months, in some cases over a year, which would absolutely horrify psychiatrists and doctors today.
And that's sort of two examples of research that really didn't do much of anything besides hurting people. But the more problematic research, in my opinion, is the research that actually was compelling and actually furthered the research. So, for example, I'm thinking about hepatitis. Tell us about some of the work that was done around that.
Well, Saul Krugman is a very well-known and controversial virologist based out of NYU in New York. He is now deceased, but he is a very highly regarded physician who in the 1950s and well into the 70s was using children at Willowbrook in New York State, and they had a terrible problem with hepatitis. And Dr. Krugman goes in there with his team of researchers and is basically given carte blanche to do whatever he wants to come up with some sort of treatment or preventative. And from the mid-50s into the 60s and 70s, he is using many, many children there to discover all he can about the disease of hepatitis. He found out that there were two different types of hepatitis, and he found out what are the best ways to fight it and what have you. And he's highly regarded as a virologist. But there are a great many people who feel that he took liberties that were very much untoward, that were unethical. Willowbrook was so overcrowded that they stopped taking children. However, parents desperate to get their children into that facility were told, if you're willing to have your child be a test subject and be given hepatitis, we will let them come into the facility. And these children were purposefully, scientifically given hepatitis. And Dr. Krugman and his team studied these children for months and years afterwards.
Just to, you know, to add another level of awful to this, how were they transmitting the hepatitis to them?
Well, they did it in various fashions. The one that I think most people blanch at, they were known as transmission studies. And what they would do at many facilities around the country and at Willowbrook is they would get the feces of already infected children and turn it into some sort of fluid that they would put in the cereal or meals of children who were healthy and then get them infected that way.
So what was the benefit to an institution for hosting these kinds of clinical trials?
In some cases, the institutions would get some money from these researchers or the hospitals or universities that were backing them. In some cases, no money crossed hands, but in fact, it was an inducement to the superintendent or the medical director of an orphanage or an insane asylum, where that individual, a medical director, would have his name on the medical journal article that would be published subsequent to the study. There are a lot of doctors out there, but a very small percentage actually do research that ends up in a major medical journal. And if you can get your name as one of the authors, it's basically a feather in your cap that moves you up the academic chain of prestige. It could also be that a pharmaceutical company would ask a superintendent or the medical director of a prison or an orphanage or what have you, if you let us do this piece of research, we will give you so much money. The doctor who writes the article will cite your institution. We will show our appreciation to you in other ways. Plus, there was nothing that would cause many of these superintendents or medical directors to shy away from this. They thought that they were making a contribution to science, to advancing knowledge, that they were turning over their minions. These people, be they adults or children, were not making any contribution to society. They saw it that they were a lag or an anchor on society, holding society back. It was costing each state, the federal government, a lot of money. This was a way for those children, those adults, to make a contribution.
Well, and you also wrote that using institutionalized children was often cheaper than using animals as test subjects.
That's absolutely right. And I document in the book a number of times where doctors sought out each other to do studies. And if they were having a difficult time, let's say during the Second World War, shipping may have been stalled. They may not have been able to get chimpanzees or monkeys, or the price of these monkeys may have skyrocketed. It was just as easy, if not easier, to get a doctor who had access to a mental hospital, to an orphanage, and ask that physician, can we do a clinical trial? So you could have a doctor at Yale University in New Haven who needed 500, 1,000, 1,500 subjects. He would write to a well-known virologist in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. They knew that person had contacts with various facilities in the Delaware Valley, and they would say to him, please assist us with this research project. We need so many hundreds test subjects. And in most cases, doctors tried to help each other out, and they knew where to go. They were not going to Ivy League schools. They were not going to prep schools. They were not going to, you know, major economic establishments like the Chamber of Commerce or what have you. They went to the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum. They used people at the bottom of the barrel, basically throwaway people whose lives were practically worthless. And over, they gained access to those facilities and used them in a cross-section of experimentation.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be back with more of Against Their Will with author Alan Hornblum after these messages.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People, and my guest is Alan Hornblum, author of Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. Okay, so being that it was the Cold War, there were, of course, radiation experiments. Tell us about Science Club.
Well, the Science Club was basically an initiative by doctors at MIT and Harvard in conjunction with an oatmeal company, Quaker Oats, where they were trying to explore the impact of phytates on nutrition. That we're talking about research just at the end of the Second World War, 45, 46, and 47. And it was basically a nutrition experiment, but in conjunction with that, to really monitor the impact of what they were working with here, they were using an outgrowth of the Manhattan Project and the whole new world of radioactive isotopes and radiation that had blossomed during that period. And what they did is they traveled from Boston to the far suburbs to Waltham, where there was a well-known institution, the Fresnel State School for the Feeble-Minded. And they went to the superintendent and the medical director, Charles Benda, and they asked if they could do a piece of research there. And they were granted permission, and they wanted to get a number of children, predominantly young boys, to take part in an experiment. And these were children who had very, very lonely, austere lives. Their parents had given them up, or the state had taken them away from the parents. They were put in these institutions. In some cases, there were people there who were profoundly retarded and disabled, but not all of them were. But you did have a great many who in that day were considered feeble-minded, and on their official papers they were declared morons because they had IQs that were sub 100. And these children were brought down to a special meeting one morning where there were some outsiders who came into the auditorium and had smiles on their faces and offered the children something new and greatly desired: trips outside the facility, that they would be taken to Fenway Park to watch baseball games. They would be taken to the beach. They would be taken to other places that these children never got a chance to go to. And they would be involved in a science project. And if they all agreed, this new venture, this science club, would be something the children would greatly enjoy, and it would help science. So these children, of course, did not have much education or any background traveling anywhere, and they just loved the prospect of getting outside the walls of this facility. So they raised their hands. They were quite excited. But what they found is that they were being sequestered from other children, and on a daily basis, they were made to urinate and defecate in glass jars. They daily had blood taken from them. And they were forced to have certain meals, certain times of the day. And unbeknownst to them, their breakfast cereal, their oatmeal, was laced with radioactive isotopes. This went on for years, from the 1940s into the 1970s. Some of these experiments became serious Cold War ventures, where doctors were actually irradiating the thyroids of children, and no one knew about it. It was kept secret. In some cases, parents were sent a memo, a letter from the medical director asking if it was okay if their child took part in a scientific venture. These letters never mentioned that they were being exposed to radioactive isotopes. They were given very little information. Some parents signed off, others never responded, but certainly the doctors who coordinated the project were very pleased. They did a lot of research, and it was not until about 1993-94 where this was exposed.
Now, you actually spoke to some of these subjects as adults years later.
That is correct. They are all now in their 70s. These men have a great distrust of the medical community, of doctors, understandably. And this is universal, quite frankly, from the former inmates who were test subjects at Holmesburg, as well as other facilities. And it shows you some of the reasons that there is resentment and distrust of the medical community and hospitals and doctors, because so many nefarious things were done over the years and over the centuries to people in the name of advancing science. So these individuals whose words I have in the book are very much upset by what took place, and would like it to be known that these things did happen, and they now caution people when I bring them with me, when I give lectures at universities and medical schools. They want the public to know, as well as young medical students and students in college, to be vigilant, to watch out, because you can be used and abused. And so that is one of the very strong repercussions of this practice of using the devalued, that it ends up causing a great distrust of medical science.
So you wrote so much about so many of these kinds of experiments, more than I would have ever thought possible. So how widespread were they exactly? How many children were involved? Do we know?
No, we do not know, and we will never know. The numbers have to be in the thousands, because it was going on in practically every state in the nation. And it happened in your major cities. A lot of people who are aware of medical experimentation may only know of the Tuskegee syphilis study, which took place in the backwoods of Alabama from the 1940s to the 1970s. And they may think that this was something that had to do with uneducated people in the backwoods in a rural community in the Deep South. Well, in fact, that's the outlier. In most cases, experiments took place in our major cities because the universities and the medical schools and the pharmaceutical companies that were doing this cutting-edge work were based in New York, in Philadelphia, in Detroit, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Houston. That is where the major hospitals are. That is where the medical schools are. That is where the bulk of the advances in science take place. Those doctors, those facilities needed test subjects on a regular basis. Some of these experiments dealing with cancer or polio or pellagra or whatever it was were dangerous, were nasty. It could end up with you coming down with the various malady, possibly killing the individual. So doctors were very, very stealth-minded in going to institutions where they felt they could do some of these tests and experiments where there would not be individuals who would blow the whistle on them. They went to facilities that held prisoners because those walls not only keep the prisoners in, but they keep the public out. And when you're dealing with children and mentally defective children, as they were called at the time, you don't even have to consider paying them. With many inmates over the years, the doctors induced or seduced the inmates to participate because they offered them money as they did at Holmesburg Prison in Philadelphia. When you're dealing with children, children basically have no concept of money, particularly if they have learning disabilities. So it really was a win-win situation for a lot of physicians. So as an example, polio was of major concern during many decades of the 20th century. You had a lot of top virologists across the country trying to develop an elixir to that problem. And most of these initiatives over the years proved faulty, defective, in some cases gave people polio. And even the top doctors, such as Jonas Salk from the University of Pittsburgh, who we now celebrate, was working on an elixir for many years. And when he thought he came up with something that would be viable, he decided that if they were going to do a clinical trial, it was not going to be done on medical students or other doctors or seniors at the University of Pittsburgh. He basically traveled to institutions in Western PA, one outside of Pittsburgh called the D.T. Watson School for Handicapped Children, as well as the Polk State School for the Feeble-Minded in Western PA. And those children were some of the first to be given the Salk vaccine. And that is a pattern that you see over and over. Doctors basically understood research medicine, that you are desperately trying to advance science, to fight some sort of medical malady that's affecting thousands of people in the country. You work on it in your laboratory for years. You deal with rats, you deal with mice, you deal with chimps and monkeys. And then when you feel you're really onto something that may be viable, you need humans to test. And it is just considered safer, wiser, more judicious during those Cold War years if you used people who did not have access to journalists, did not have access to lawyers or people of influence.
I got to a certain point in this book, and all I could think is, are there any diseases that we have found treatments or cures for that we didn't test involuntarily on children? Because, you know, hepatitis, polio, the flu, measles, ringworm. Is there anything left?
I cannot really give you a firm answer on that. I mean, there have been advances in science for as long as man has been on the planet. Some have done a great deal of good work. Others have damaged people in the process. And not every advance has come by using institutionalized populations or children, and not every time children or vulnerable people were incorporated were they damaged. But it is just the very sad fact of medical history, and this is basically the underbelly of American medicine, that too often people without the wherewithal, basically powerless individuals, were incorporated as test subjects because it was considered wiser, safer, cheaper to do it that way.
You're listening to Science for the People, and my guest is Alan Hornblum, author of Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. So part of this is very confusing to me because the Nuremberg Code explicitly put limits on medical experimentation. So maybe you can talk a bit about the code?
The United States was the nation that put the Nazi doctors on trial for their horrendous, barbarous experiments on concentration camp prisoners during the Second World War. We tried 23 of them. We found them guilty. We executed seven of them. Many others got long prison sentences. And then at the end of that trial, we came down with a body of 10 principles known as the Nuremberg Code to protect test subjects from doctors and researchers and scientists. Unfortunately, you could make the argument that that Nuremberg Code never left Nuremberg. Almost from day one, the American medical community basically said that code was for Nazi barbarians. It wasn't for American doctors. The result is that you see a pattern of behavior by American physicians and researchers where they went about doing their research, incorporating all sorts of vulnerable populations that if they followed the Nuremberg Code, they could have never used. And that is one of the sad facts of medical research in American history, that we tried the Nazis, but as we are doing that, we have doctors in America who are examining very sick, syphilis-ridden men in Macon County, Alabama, never telling them they have syphilis and never treating them. In addition to that, we have doctors from the public health department at the same time we're trying the Nazis going to Guatemala and giving mental patients, children, and prisoners syphilis. Just after the war, we are doing experiments where we are going into hospitals and injecting sick people with plutonium to see what the impact will be on them.
But there was definitely resistance by some people in the medical community.
There is no doubt that there are some doctors who recognized that transgressions were taking place and would not have any part of it. But there are all too few examples where doctors recognized something untoward was happening and blew the whistle on it. It was thought that it would basically curtail, if not kill, your career. So doctors went along with it in all too many instances.
Well, I found it fascinating that some of the people that you spoke to for the book, some of the doctors and clinicians, even in hindsight, they still think that it was an acceptable means to an end.
As well they should, since that was the dominant culture for all of those decades, and arguably it's still there. Recently, we've had an example in America where 1,300 premature children were incorporated in oxygenation experiments at major medical facilities around the country. This has been a long-standing problem of how much oxygen do you give a preemie. If you give too much or too little, it could result in either blindness or death. But 1,300 of these preemies were incorporated recently in a study. The parents were never informed that this experiment could go awry, and if their child received too much or too little oxygen, could result in the child's death or blindness. The fact is that this went on for some time at major medical institutions around the country. No one blew the whistle on it.
You note in your book that much of this kind of research has now been outsourced to other countries.
That is correct. Doctors, pharmaceutical companies, universities, various institutions wanting to do research now go to developing nations in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, basically for the same reasons that they went to institutions that held the feeble-minded in the 1920s and 1930s. Because they wanted to do a piece of research, they wanted to do it quickly, they wanted to do it cheaply, and they wanted to do it without any sort of problem if anything should go wrong. And when they're working in various parts of the world where the citizenry is desperate for healthcare or for some money, they get involved in these projects, not fully understanding what could happen to them. And it's basically a replication of what took place 175 years ago.
You know, I try to end every episode on kind of a cheerful note, and I got nothing. Thanks for being here, Alan, mostly.
Well, thank you for your interest in this subject, because a number of things have taken place that should not have. And only through an involved and intelligent citizenry can we ensure that these things will not happen again.
Well put, sir. And you can find a link to Alan Hornblum in his book, Against Their Will, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back to discuss some controversial topics in the field of genetics with journalist Erica Check Hayden right after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're learning more about the fourth dimension with a look at the brain science and the physics of time. Desiree Schell speaks to BBC journalist Claudia Hammond about her book, Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. And astrophysicist and blogger Ethan Siegel returns to talk to Rochelle Saunders about the physics of time travel. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my next guest today is Erica Check Hayden. Erica is a San Francisco-based reporter for the science journal Nature, where she covers biomedicine and biology. She also teaches in the University of California Santa Cruz Science Communication Program. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Now, you wrote an article for Nature in October, and I have been thinking about it ever since I read it. The title was Ethics, Taboo Genetics, and it was a great piece. So, speaking in broad strokes, what makes certain kinds of science controversial exactly? Like, do the kinds of research that one might consider taboo share any common themes?
Well, one common theme is that this research all tends to touch on topics that are hotly debated in society and that, you know, people are divided over the best way to approach them. So, for instance, if you look at genetics, there's a lot of genetics right now that's touching on the issue of intelligence and just leaving aside any kind of, you know, scientific approach to the question. Intelligence is already sort of inherently a difficult topic for our society to grapple with. There are many questions about how we measure intelligence, what it means to be intelligent, what we should do if we find that there are certain members of society who are quote unquote more or less intelligent. Should we be devoting resources more to those who need to be brought up to a certain baseline level of achievement, or should we be devoting resources to helping people, you know, fulfill their potential if they're already, you know, quote unquote high functioning? So these are already controversial areas, and the implications of the research in these areas is where things start to get really contentious.
Right. It seems like it's the kinds of science that provide moral pronouncements in some way.
Right. And I think this is especially interesting in genetics because people tend to view genetics as a little bit different from other fields of science in that they think that genes are destiny. And it's a little similar to things that you might see in neuroscience where researchers might be using brain scans to examine differences in the brains of people who might have certain behaviors. The way that people tend to interpret these studies is that these studies are telling us that people are destined to behave in certain ways. That's not at all the case. It's certainly not the case in genetics. It's usually not the case in neuroscience. But because people perceive these studies as, you know, sort of destining people to fulfill certain fates, they tend to be extremely controversial.
Why do you think there's so much controversy within genetics specifically?
Human beings are very complex, and we're always searching for clues about why we do the things we do. Not only sort of why human nature is the way that it appears to be the way it is, but also why we as human beings sort of take different paths and make different choices. And I think that we hope or believe that genetics and neuroscience to a certain extent can help provide some of the answers to those questions. And so, you know, we look at genetics. I think it was our director of our National Institutes of Health here, Francis Collins, sort of famously called the Human Genome Project, you know, he said that it was decoding or reading the book of life. You know, we want genetics to give us those answers. We want neuroscience to give us those answers. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't, but the idea that it might is very appealing.
Well, you wrote about four categories of genetics that make people generally uncomfortable. And you already mentioned one, intelligence. And I know from personal experience that talking about IQ is practically guaranteed to start a vicious argument. So maybe tell us why that would be.
There's just so much debate in society about what intelligence is in the first place. And there's debate in the scientific community about what intelligence is and how meaningful it is. What we do know about the genetics of intelligence is that genes, they do affect a person's eventual intelligence, but they don't tell the whole story. So there's a lot that goes on with a person's interactions with the environment that also affect their eventual intelligence. The other problem with intelligence, or I guess, you know, not problem, but it's a complexity, is that, you know, how do you measure intelligence? There are these IQ tests, and they certainly are one way to gauge, a certain type of intelligence. But, you know, a person's score on an IQ test can change over time. You can train for an IQ test, et cetera, et cetera. It's not necessarily a measure of innate ability. So, you know, in intelligence, you can look at other things in sort of the broad category of intelligence. You can look at how well a person does on math tests or reading tests. And you can also look at things like how long a person stays in school. And when you do those things, you find that these are traits that are not going to be simply explained by one or two genes. So if you ever see a study that's telling you that it's found the gene for some kind of intelligence, reading ability, math ability, it's certainly going to be wrong. And you should take all those studies with a grain of salt.
Well, then what kinds of things can intelligence research be used for practically?
The real answer right now is not much. The genetics of intelligence, let's just make that clear. You know, if anybody is making a pronouncement that based on a particular type of genetic study at the moment, you know, there's some sort of implication about the policy or education policy that we should draw from it, that's absolutely not true. This is the big question, is what would we do if we knew sort of the genetic contributors to intelligence? There are geneticists like Robert Plowman in England who argue that if we knew sort of people's genetic proclivities in certain subjects, then we could use that to tailor education uniquely suited to that person's needs. And of course, that's an extremely attractive idea. But I think what people are afraid of is more, you know, the contrary, that it'll just be used to discriminate against the less, you know, quote unquote, intelligent, and that it'll be used in, you know, horrible applications like parents trying to select smarter babies. And, you know, unfortunately, if you look at our history, it's true that we haven't really used science to help, you know, the quote unquote, less intelligent. And right. So that's where that fear comes from.
So it's understandable then.
I think it's understandable that people are, you know, afraid of the way this research is used. There's a kind of broad diversity among the scientists themselves about how to address these fears. I've seen people do a very good job of sort of addressing the fears. I've seen people contribute to the fears by saying things like, you know, if it were possible to select smarter babies, why wouldn't we do that? When you're a scientist and you're working mostly with other scientists, you just might not be aware of the way that things will sound when they're, you know, reported in a news story or when the public hears them. And so I think one thing that I really came away from this story believing is that researchers should be extremely proactive about the way that they present this research to the public, and that they should be extremely sensitive about it. And you know, even if they mean no harm, and they almost always don't, you know, mean that these things should be used in a harmful way, they need to be extremely sensitive about people's fear that it will be used incorrectly.
Well, moving on to research about race and genetics, another topic that you spoke about, if there is anything even more fraught with danger than talking about intelligence, it is talking about race. So give us some background.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's because throughout our history, there's been a lot of pseudoscience that has been used to discriminate against various races. And the difficulty here is that in the modern day, it's becoming kind of increasingly clear that the genetic differences within races are greater than those among races. So if you look at sort of traditionally defined racial groupings like Europeans or Africans or Asians, These racial categories or ethnic categories, people across them share a lot more genetics than divides them. And so the big question for me is, why would researchers still be looking for differences across these racial categories?
Indeed.
And I think, yeah, there's not really good evidence to suggest that they're going to find anything, and yet people continue to look. And so I think this is the area where I came away most convinced that this is probably the closest to more of like a no-go area for researchers, with good reason, because if there's not really good evidence that there's going to be differences, why continue to look?
Is there any way that this research could be used in a positive way?
One promise, the way that it's been sold, is that it could be used to, for instance, find medicines that might be more helpful for people from particular racial groups. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that in an age when we are able to learn more about the genetics of individuals than we've ever been able to before, and we're able to, you know, look at all the relevant portions of a person's genome for hundreds of dollars, which is something we could never do in the past, that personalized, individualized information is going to be so much more useful in predicting the person's sort of medical proclivities, or, you know, the person's medical vulnerabilities, than any sort of broad categorization that would be based on, you know, what's usually amounts to that person's skin color. So to me, the idea that race is a useful proxy for medicine is kind of becoming less and less relevant as we learn more and more about individual genetics and how they relate to medical risk.
You also list violence as taboo genetics. And is it really that controversial?
I think this is one area that's become possibly less controversial over time, because researchers really haven't found any genes that by themselves predispose people to criminal behavior, you know, in the broad majority of the population. The reason why violence and genetics is interesting is because this is an area where it is already being applied in the criminal justice system. So there have been studies that look at, for instance, why people who are maltreated as children, why some of them might go on to commit criminal behaviors and others might not. Why are some people more resilient to this kind of early maltreatment? And it has been found that there is a particular gene that, when found in one version, seems to protect people from the effects of this early maltreatment, and in another version, seems to predispose them to criminal behavior. So it's this gene-environment interaction that's been looked at. So what you have seen is, in trials, you have seen defense attorneys present the results of tests on their client to say, look, my client was maltreated as a child. He also has the form of this gene that sort of predisposes to criminal behavior. Therefore, some of this is out of his hands. He really couldn't control his actions, and we should give him, you know, a lesser sentence. And so I think that's the interesting thing about the violence genetics, is that it's already being applied in society. The other interesting thing about it is that juries seem to do a pretty good job of processing this information, in understanding that it's not determinative, in understanding that this is maybe one risk factor that they would need to weigh along with several other risk factors. So it doesn't at all, it doesn't universally sort of end up with the person getting a more lenient sentence or a more lenient penalty.
You also list sexuality as a taboo field, and this is another area where this seems to have changed over time.
Yeah, I think that sexuality is so interesting, because it does show how what is considered taboo entirely relates to what is considered taboo in society. So it was in the early 1990s that you saw researchers start to begin to look for genetic links to sexuality. And at the time, it was extremely controversial. There were a lot of groups who didn't accept or believe that there was a biological basis to sexuality, that who believed that this was essentially a choice, and who reacted very strongly against these studies. Fast forward, you know, 20 years later now, and the research has become much less controversial, I think largely in tandem with the greater social acceptance of different sexual orientation than, you know, traditional just heterosexual orientation. So, for instance, you saw in the campaign for the campaign against Proposition 8, which was the measure here in California that was going to ban same-sex marriage, You saw the people fighting against that proposition enlist genetic evidence to show that, you know, this is not necessarily a choice. This is something that is partially biologically affected, you know, therefore people shouldn't be discriminated against. And you saw that argument, I think, play a large role in the campaign against that proposition.
Well, do you think that any of the other fields might see that kind of change in perspective over time?
I think that broadly, the more we come to actually understand the genetic basis for these traits, I do think that there's a pretty strong likelihood that they'll become less controversial. And I say that because I think that researchers are guessing based on their best evidence that all of these traits are probably going to be affected by many, many genes, and that each of these genes is going to have a very tiny effect. And so what you'll end up with in the end is a picture that's extremely complex. And I'd be very surprised if at the end of all of this, we're really going to be able to go into a person's genome and say with any confidence that this person is going to end up with, you know, this particular type of intelligence and this particular proclivity to behavior and this particular personality. I could be wrong, but I do think that the more we understand about genetics and how complex it is and how it interplays with environmental and social factors, you know, the less determinative we can be about it. And I think that'll sort of decrease the controversy.
Well, that would be lovely, because in the past, we've unfortunately used research like this to support horrible things like forced sterilization. And that was primarily focused on minorities and poor people and people with mental illnesses.
Absolutely. And I think that's a bigger piece of this, is that a lot of times science is enlisted to support pre-existing biases in society. And so I think that's why you've seen some, not necessarily researchers, but ethicists and commentators argue that, you know, there are certain areas of research that we just shouldn't do because we're just not responsible about doing them. So for instance, in race, people have argued that this research is almost always motivated by a bias when we're looking for genetic differences among the races. We're not coming to it from, you know, a blank slate place of we'd be open to anything that comes out. That usually the argument is scientists are coming to this with sort of a predetermined notion that they're going to find that certain races are better at some things than others. And so as long as societal prejudice exists, that's going to happen, unfortunately.
Well, okay, so there are no-go areas in your mind. But how do we draw the line? Because I guess we shouldn't really ever say that we shouldn't ever do certain kinds of research based solely on the fact that it just might be used negatively in the future. How do we draw that line?
I completely agree that, you know, and I think the scientific fields feel very strongly that, you know, we shouldn't not be doing research just because it could potentially be misused by someone down the line. I think in my mind, the question is like, is there really a good scientific reason for doing the study? And so, for instance, if you're looking at questions of race and differences in intelligence, if people have looked for this for many, many years and they haven't found kind of a biological grounding for it, and, you know, the research coming out is telling us that it's unlikely to be there, what's the good that's gained by going in and looking anyway? And of course, you can't necessarily stop somebody from doing this, but as society, we are the ones who fund, you know, for instance, government research agencies. And so, you know, that's the level where we are able to influence decisions about priorities and research. And so if it's determined that there's no really good scientific basis for doing this research, then I think that's a legitimate place to take a step back and ask, you know, what's the good of going forward with it?
Sounds rational to me. Erica, thanks very much for being here.
Sure. Thanks so much.
We've linked to Erica's Nature article on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. Do click that link and click the links to everywhere that we exist on social media. And most importantly, click the links to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, download past episodes, or write a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.